Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Which ocean may be the surest route to power and prosperity for the remainder of the 21st century? Given the biases of our geographic location, most Americans are likely to answer Atlantic or Pacific. But my guest today suggests that it is the Indian Ocean, a vast body of water often overlooked by the West, but offering vital trade routes and sources of wealth and cultural exchange to much of Asia and Eastern Africa. Robert D. Kaplan is a fellow at the Center for a New American Security and a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. His new book is called Monsoon, The Indian Ocean and the Future of American Power. Robert, welcome to Think.
It's a pleasure to be here, Chris.
You argue here that the greater Indian Ocean is as iconic to the 21st century as Europe was to the 20th. Can you talk about that?
Yes. First of all, by the greater Indian Ocean, I mean from the Horn of Africa all the way 4,000 miles across to the Indonesian archipelago and the South China Sea. This is the world's energy interstate. It's where all of the hydrocarbons, the oil and natural gas from the Arabian Peninsula and the Iranian Plateau, get shipped across the water to the burgeoning middle-class fleshpots of Asia, that the coastal cities of China, Japan, and South Korea. The Indian Ocean also encompasses the entire arc of Islam, from the Sahara Desert in the west to the Indonesian archipelago in the east. It's a way of kind of combining the centrality of the Middle East and China together in one unit, and while also taking in, obviously, India and the Indian subcontinent. When you think that the news headlines include Iraq, Iran, Pakistan, India, Burma, and China, which does not exactly have a littoral on the Indian Ocean, but which is never far from its gaze because of its own maritime history, you can see how this ocean is central to the future news headlines of the 21st century.
Yeah, what's so interesting about your take on this is that we tend to think in this country of Islam as being a desert faith, but in fact you point out that these days it really is a seafaring faith.
Yes. We've been concerned with the 600 million Muslims who live in the greater Middle East and Pakistan, which make up our news headlines. But there are 580 million Muslims who live in India, in southwestern Burma, all over Indonesia, all through Malaysia, all through the southern Philippines. And when you look at Islam through the filter of the Indian Ocean, you see it as a great seafaring faith. We think of Islam as a desert religion, supposedly prone to the extremities of thought to which deserts give rise. But as a great seafaring faith, Islam spread gradually across the longitudes by sophisticated merchants who brought with them a very cosmopolitan view of the faith that overlaid naturally onto indigenous Javanese culture in Indonesia, indigenous Malay culture, indigenous Hindu culture in India, and so on.
Can you talk about what makes monsoon the appropriate metaphor for what's taking place around the Indian Ocean?
Yes. When Americans hear the word monsoon, they tend to think of a storm or some catastrophe. Actually, this is not quite right. A monsoon is a wind and weather pattern, and this wind and weather pattern is necessary for growth, agricultural prosperity, and other good things. Now, of all the world's oceans, the Indian Ocean is the only one that has a monsoonal weather pattern. That is to say, what defines the monsoon is that it's a wind system that is utterly predictable. The monsoon winds flow in one direction, northeast, southwest, for 6 months a year, then reverse themselves and flow in the other direction for another 6 months of the year. Because the monsoon is predictable, sailors, as far back as antiquity, have been able to predict sailing distances, when to sail, when they will arrive. This is incredible to anyone in the audience who's a recreational sailor, where it's impossible sometimes to predict the winds just 20 or 30 miles out, as opposed to here we're talking about winds that can be predicted up to 4,000 miles out. And because the monsoon winds are so predictable, everyone could get everywhere in the ocean, so that the Indian Ocean did not have to wait for the age of steamships to unite it. It's a reason why you find large Malay communities from Southeast Asia living in Madagascar off the coast of East Africa. It's why you find large Yemeni communities from the Arabian Peninsula living in large numbers in Indonesia and Southeast Asia and so on.
Is it possible to describe a sort of shared culture among the, is it 37 states that border the Indian Ocean?
Or 38, I can't recall right at the moment. But yes, there is a shared culture. It's in a way, it's a small, intimate ocean, as big as it is. And because it's, you know, I also forgot to mention that there are Gujaratis from northeast western India all over the Indian Ocean. There are Omanis from Arabia all through East Africa. All this cross-fertilization of cultures and ethnicities is because of the monsoon winds. And there is a common culture. And this is very useful in terms of strategy. Let me explain. At the end of the Cold War, at the end of World War II, the United States found itself a great global power, and it needed area expertise for all the parts of the world, especially Eurasia. So we artificially divided the world into the Middle East, Central Asia, South Asia, Southeast Asia, East Asia. The universities did this, think tanks did this, news organizations did this, the Pentagon, the CIA, and the Defense Department did this. But in fact, what has been going on in recent years is a collapse of these boundaries, as you find China heavily engaged in Iran, and Yemenis heavily engaged in Indonesia. To think of the Indian Ocean as one organic, fluid, cultural continuum gives us kind of a functional sense of the world without these artificial borders of area expertise.
You know, what's interesting, Robert, is it doesn't happen this way anymore on maps, but I'm thinking of the world maps that hung in the classrooms when I was a kid, and they always, of course, put North and South America smack dab in the middle, and what that ended up doing was sort of cutting the Indian Ocean in half, so you almost didn't notice it.
Yes. We Americans, we've not only been prisoners of Cold War area expertise, we've been prisoners of the Mercator projection. Which is a flat rectangular map with, as you said, North and South America in the center, and the parts of the Indian and Pacific Oceans consigned to the edges of the map, split apart, and thus kind of put at the edges of our consciousness. But what I'm saying in this book is that a more accurate map of the 21st century world would have the Indian Ocean front and center.
You mentioned Oman earlier, and you write pretty extensively about it in this book, which is interesting because there are fewer than 3 million people there. It's a pretty small state bordered by Yemen and Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Can you talk about why you think it's such an interesting place to know about?
Well, it's interesting for both historical and modern political reasons. It's interesting historically because the Arabian Sea, which is one half of the Indian Ocean, used to be called the Sea of Oman. That's how influential Omani sailors and traders were throughout the Indian Ocean. It's possible that open water sailing began off the coast of Oman, which has very few navigable rivers, has mainly clear starlit nights, and is close to the borders of Iran, across the Persian Gulf, and elsewhere. So it's a very substantial country historically. It's always had two personalities: a desert personality, which has been very insular, tribal, and it for long periods chaotic, and a more cosmopolitan coastal personality tied to the cities of the coast like Zohar, like Muscat, and Salalah and others. And because and so in a sense, India was closer to the Omani coast through sailing than the Omani coast was to the Omani desert right next door. Oman is also very interesting in a modern political sense because it's governed by an absolute dictator. But on the other hand, he's very classically liberal in his own thinking. This is Sultan Qaboos bin Said. And he's an example of how you don't necessarily need democracy to have good government. He's developed real fair, usable institutions and bureaucracies in Oman. Oman is a real state. It's not an artificial compendium. I mean, he's created what was a mere geographical expression into a real state through good liberal governance that gets basically good reports on the State Department's Human Rights Index issued every year, and all this through absolute dictatorship.
Yeah, and in fact, it was named by the United Nations Development Program as the most improved nation in the world over the past 40 years.
Yeah, I did not know that. Had I known that, I would have put it in the book. Thanks. But it proves my point that, you know, and so Oman is a way to illustrate how we Americans don't have all the answers. That our legalistic missionary approach to exporting multi-party democracy may be flawed.
How have our conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan helped to fast forward the arrival of what you call the Asian century?
Yes. For the last decade, the United States has been preoccupied with messy land wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that have engaged mainly our Army and our Marine Corps. Our Navy and Air Force have been less engaged. While we've been preoccupied with these land wars, Asian militaries have been growing apace. It's not just the tremendous growth of the Chinese Navy, which has been heavily reported and which I write about in the book. It's also the Japanese Navy, which is now four times the size of the British Royal Navy. It's about the growth of the Indian Navy and Air Force, which is going to be the third largest in the world in the not-too-distant future. It's about, while European defense budgets are starved, Southeast Asian governments have been given 30% more money to their defense and security budgets over the last decade. It's not just economic power that's moving to Asia. It's military power as well. And by taking our eye off the ball, by the need to be engaged for so long in Iraq and Afghanistan, we've kind of fast-forwarded this phenomenon.
Because it's happened while we weren't paying attention.
Exactly. And to give you an example of that, you know the expression, so much of life is just showing up.
Yeah.
Well, for a year, I don't believe former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice went to Asia while she was Secretary of State. So immersed was she in Iraq issues and Afghanistan and Israel-Palestine issues. Well, now we've rectified that situation somewhat. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has been going back and forth to East Asia, which is a good thing. But it's not just the fiscal expense of these wars. It's that ultimately the most crucial
Let me have you pause there, Robert. We need to take a break, and we'll get back to this in a minute. Robert D. Kaplan is my guest. His new book is called Monsoon, The Indian Ocean and the Future of American Power. We'll be back in a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert D. Kaplan. He's a fellow at the Center for a New American Security and national correspondent for The Atlantic. His new book is called Monsoon, The Indian Ocean and the Future of American Power. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Before the break interrupted us, Robert, you were talking about the fact that Secretary of State Clinton does seem to have made a concerted effort to be physically present and also intellectually present in what's going on in East.
Yeah, at the end of the day, the most important resource that a state has is the attention of its top policymakers. And if its top policymakers are distracted with two land wars and in Iraq and Afghanistan and with the Israel-Palestine situation, there's not a lot of energy left at the very top to deal with this emerging world that I talk about in my book, in particular East Asia, India. It was about a year that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice did not make a trip to Asia, so immersed was she in problems of the greater Middle East. Secretary Clinton has rectified this, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, that is, by making repeated trips to East Asia and South Asia. And one of the reasons why she's been able to do this is by the appointing of special presidential envoys to Israel, Palestine, Afghanistan, Pakistan, so that she's not, on a day-to-day basis at least, immersed in those two big issues.
Let's talk a little bit about Indonesia. We know, of course, that the president was just there, and much was made during the campaign about the time that he had spent there and the fact that it is a majority Muslim country. But it really is, as you describe it here, a remarkable place.
Yeah, it is. Indonesia has 240 million people, 200 million of whom are Muslims. This makes Indonesia the most populous Muslim society in the world. Indonesia has been democratic with multi-party elections for over a decade now. It has not lurched into radicalism, nor has it lurched into instability. It's emerged into a modern, moderate, stable, democratic country under largely Muslim rule. This is in significant contrast to developments in the Middle East proper. Indonesia also sits at the confluence of the major sea lanes of the world, where the Indian Ocean meets the Western Pacific, where so much of world energy traffic has to navigate the narrow Strait of Malacca between the Indonesian island of Sumatra and the Malay Peninsula. Indonesia also has tremendous deposits of oil and natural gas. There's a figure in my book when talking about environmental or seismic disasters, that something like 7 out of 10 people who live within a few miles of an active volcano in the world live in Indonesia.
Hmm. So how far can you stretch comparisons between what's been happening in Indonesia over the past decade or two and what's taken place in India?
Yes. India, starting with the second administration of Bill Clinton, right up through all 8 years of the Bush administration and into the Obama administration, has been kind of America's favorite country. And this is because there's been no international development that has been such a good stroke of luck for American policymakers as the emergence of India as a great economic and military power. Because simply by rising as it does, without necessarily leaning towards the United States, India acts as a balancer against the rise of China, so as to preserve the balance of power in Eurasia. Again, let me emphasize, we don't need a formal alliance with India for this to happen. It's happening naturally. Now, it's my belief that the Obama administration should try to make Indonesia its favorite country the way that the Bush administration successfully and to substantial effect made India its favorite country. India was probably the most successful part of George W. Bush's foreign policy. I think the Obama administration should take a leaf from that and apply it to Indonesia, because given Indonesia's large population, its strategic location, and its centrality to the Islamic world, and its stability under democracy, Indonesia has a great future as a very important country in the world system.
Does the moderate Islam of Indonesia have the ability to spread deliberately beyond the archipelago?
It can certainly spread to the Philippines, to Malaysia. Malaysians are very impressed with Indonesian democracy. So it can further anchor, you know, a democratic legitimacy for Islam in the Far East. But I'm not sure, despite global communications and all of that, that it can really affect things in the Middle East proper.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to this. Maybe it's not rivalry, but certainly great competition between China and India. How would you characterize the state of relations between those two countries right now?
Well, the first thing to keep in mind is China and India, separated as they are by the high walls of the Himalayas, evolved as two fundamentally separate and rich civilizations that really didn't have all that much to do with each other throughout much of history. So if there's no history of an ancient hatred or fundamental dislike between Indians and Chinese, the rivalry that I see developing now between the two countries is mainly a function of the shrinkage of distance brought on by the advancement of military technology and other forms of technology, so that you have Chinese airfields in Tibet with fighter jets whose arc of operations includes India. You have Indian warships in the South China Sea. You have Chinese warships in the Indian Ocean. These two nations are expanding their influence, and thus their spheres of influence overlap, and this is leading into a rivalry of sorts that will probably become more pronounced as the 21st century moves along.
So both sides are bulking up their military capabilities, but how strong, how robust are the diplomatic channels for resolving conflicts?
They're very robust. China and India are at pains to keep their relationship stable. Also, there's the economic relationship to consider that I mentioned briefly in my book, that China and India, because of the size of their economies, are poised to have the world's largest bilateral trading relationship.
Robert D. Kaplan is my guest. His new book is called Monsoon, The Indian Ocean and the Future of American Power. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Does all of this between India and China present any conflicts of interest for the United States in dealing separately with each country?
No, I don't think so. I think it presents significant opportunity for the United States, mm-hmm, because the United States Navy is, in relative terms, diminishing, very gradually and only in relative terms, but it is diminishing. Nevertheless, because of the power rivalries that are emerging in Eurasia, where you have this rising Chinese power that countries like India, Indonesia, Japan, South Korea, etc., need to balance against, the U.S. Navy and Air Force, and the U.S. in general, becomes the indispensable Asian power, the only Asian power that has no territorial ambitions on the mainland of Asia, the only power that all these other countries can agree upon that's necessary to be there to essentially help guide and make peaceful China's inevitable rise.
Can you talk about how things take place on the international waters within the Indian Ocean, and who is where, and what sorts of activities different navies are conducting there?
Well, in a military and naval sense, we're still in a unipolar world. First of all, you cannot disaggregate naval power from air power from space power. They're all interrelated now because ships are guided by GPS satellites in space, for example. In a military sense, as I said, we're still in a unipolar world. The U.S. Navy is still far more dominant than even the Chinese Navy, which is second. But the distances are closing. The Chinese will have more submarines in the water in a decade or two than the United States has. China is really emphasizing submarines, missiles, the ability to hit GPS satellites in space, anti-access capabilities. Nevertheless, the sea lines of communication between the Middle East, across the Indian Ocean, all the way to the Straits of Malacca, Makassa, and Lombok Straits in archipelagic Indonesia, and up through the South China Sea. Those sea lines of communication, to the degree that they're protected, are protected by the United States Navy. Piracy, though a great media story, is still at the level where it's an interesting nuisance rather than a strategic threat.
Robert D. Kaplan is my guest. His new book, Monsoon, The Indian Ocean and the Future of American Power. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Dasarad in Grapevine. Hi, Dasarad.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call, Chris.
Sure.
Actually, India it was a British colony for a long time, and British, they, even though it was technically very advanced, they never shared technology with India. In fact, whatever technology they brought to India, they brought it to basically move India's riches back to England. Mm-hmm. Whereas U.S., being very open, all the inventions it came up with in 20th century, whether it was computer or internet, it shared with rest of the world. That's probably why India and China are two emerging superpowers, because of Americans' openness. So I want your guest to comment on that.
Yes, this is true. Keep in mind that the United States probably has more bilateral Air Force exercises with the Indian Air Force than any other nation in the world. Our militaries, the U.S. and Indian militaries, are increasingly intertwined. The U.S. would like to sell in India more really important, really expensive military items, ships, planes, etc., and to limit to kind of bring down export control so that we can really share this technology with India.
Let's talk a little bit about tiny little Zanzibar, a place where some remarkable changes have taken place in recent years. Can you tell us about Zanzibar?
Zanzibar is really at the it's at the crossroads of the Indian Ocean because of the nature of the monsoon winds. On one street in Zanzibar, I encountered people from South Asia, Southeast Asia, the Far East, the Arabian Peninsula. All this on this one street in this little island, just a little bit off the coast of what is today Tanzania in East Africa. Now, had I been in Zanzibar a few decades earlier, in the 1950s or 1940s, the cosmopolitanism would have been even more intense. There's been a certain degree of Africanization that I write about in the book in recent decades. But still, Zanzibar is an incredibly cosmopolitan place and is really a wondrous location to explore the Indian Ocean. It's old city called Stone Town. It's kind of as beautiful and uninfested by tourists as probably the Greek islands were in the 1950s, after the World War II, but before the tourist invasion.
Is there anything about the conditions in Zanzibar that is scalable to continental Africa?
That is scalable?
Well, that could be sort of transformed and...
I use Zanzibar as a metaphor to talk about how Indian, Chinese, and Persian Gulf in, influence and investment is changing the face of Africa. It's interesting that Africa will develop less because of Western foreign aid than because of investment from what is in fact the former third world in South Asia, East Asia, and the Middle East. And some of this investment takes has been called neo-colonialism, neo-imperialism. I'm referring to, you know, Chinese cobalt and iron ore mines in the Congo. But in any rate, even if it is that, there's a lot going on in Africa that to me showed that Africa is going to be caught up in this great reemerging trading network that goes all the way from East Africa to East Asia.
Does China, in your estimation, have any designs on political control of those places where it's putting resources and also extracting resources?
No, I don't think so. I think what China would like to do is extract the oil, extract the strategic metals and the strategic minerals from Africa, build railways and roads to these quarries, do their extraction and not get involved in the politics. But that's hard to do.
Yeah.
Because once you're building roads and railways through a country, you get inexorably wound up in its politics. And in this sense, China could be overextending itself in Africa. It could get caught up in African turbulence.
My guest is Robert D. Kaplan. He's a fellow at the Center for a New American Security and a national correspondent for The Atlantic. His new book is called Monsoon, The Indian Ocean and the Future of American Power. We'll resume our conversation in just a couple of minutes. You can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert D. Kaplan. His new book is called Monsoon, The Indian Ocean and the Future of American Power. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll go back to the phones now, this time speak with David in Dallas. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi there. A bit of a two-part question. One, the role of Taiwan in the short-term development of the region. And second part, do you see an eventual reunification with Taiwan in the mainland? Thanks.
Yes, David. There are 120 flights per week. That's commercial flights per week between Taiwan and the Chinese mainland. There are also 1,300 short-range ballistic missiles pointed at Taiwan from the Chinese mainland. In other words, Taiwan is being gradually enveloped in both a peaceful way and in a very intimidating way by mainland China. The time is not far off, a decade or two, when U.S. defense of Taiwan will become harder and harder. As Taiwan is consolidated or enmeshed in mainland China's political economic system, China will be able to focus outward more at the first and second island chains in the Pacific and into the greater Indian Ocean.
We have an email here from Bill in Dallas who wants to know about the future impacts to Russian power by the Indian Ocean countries and how diplomacy might evolve.
Well, Russia is implicated in the Indian Ocean's economic and strategic system in the sense that Russia is competing for influence with China and Iran in Central Asia. And particularly if Afghanistan turns out not too badly, you will have a webwork of pipelines, roads, and railways that will connect mineral and hydrocarbon-rich Central Asia with ports on the Indian Ocean, principally through Pakistan, secondarily through Iran. So you could have 30 years hence, or say, a situation where Russia will be tied in with Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan, which in turn will be tied in with Afghanistan and Pakistan in a kind of new Silk Route nexus that will have both a land and a maritime framework.
Given the strategic importance of the Strait of Malacca, can you talk about the powers involved in ensuring that that remains open and accessible and available to everyone who wants to use it?
Well, at the moment, the Malaysian, the Singaporean, and the Indonesian navies are cooperating with advice from the United States Navy in patrolling the Strait of Malacca to keep it free of piracy. But given how narrow the Strait of Malacca is, given the shoals in the Strait of Malacca, given the dramatic increase that we will see in sea traffic due to the increasing appetite that East Asia will have for fossil fuels and the need to transport them from the Middle East, the Strait of Malacca will become increasingly insecure in the future. And one of the ways being thought to alleviate that is some feasibility studies being done to build a canal across the Isthmus of Kra in southern Thailand and land bridges across the Malaysian Peninsula that would connect the Bay of Bengal with the South China Sea. This would make it easier for China, Japan, and South Korea to get their energy from the Indian Ocean.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next, we go on the phones to Kumar in Plano. Hi, Kumar.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a little skeptical about India and China relations. You know, it comes from our history that we fought, India and China have fought a war. And, you know, the trade relations between India and China is, you know, because any overtures that China does or India does, it's, that the trust is missing between the two countries. And so I'm a little skeptical about the relationship, and especially, you know, even a couple of months back with the Dalai Lama, you know, he visited India. So there's always, you know, this political and, military things going on between India and China.
Robert, what do you think? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Kumar. And then we'll
and also the second part of my question is the relationship between America and India. The Indian Prime Minister, he made a comment that, you know, we're not looking for, you know, being an outsource destination, be it the call centers or the IT infrastructure. What we want is U.S. investments in nuclear technology, power generation, and infrastructure.
What do you think, Robert?
I think Kumar raises some really strong issues here. Yes, there is a basic lack of trust between India and China. That's very true. There was a war fought in 1962 in the Himalayan foothills that China won and which was a great humiliation for India. Since that time, though, there have been no wars. Nevertheless, China still lays theoretical claim to the Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh in the northeast of India. I think, though, that what we're going to see in the future is increasing rivalry between India and China, though both governments are going to do their very best to keep that rivalry within bounds, because any miscalculation would have disastrous consequences for each country. As far as the U.S.-India relationship goes, in fact, the U.S., the U.S. through its civil nuclear deal with India is going to be transferring nuclear technology to India. I think the most important rising relationship that the U.S. has now is with India, and hopefully it will be with Indonesia as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Brian in Irving. Hello, Brian.
Yes, hello. Thank you for a great show. I'm actually from Southern Africa, Zimbabwe to be exact. So I got a two-pronged question. How do you think the dynamic that the author is discussing is going to impact the African economy and geopolitics? That's number one. Number two, given that essentially Africa is, there could be a contest for Africa between China and the United States insofar as influence is concerned, what is the United States doing to try to show up the influence in the continent of Africa?
Thanks for your call.
All right, well, thanks. For the first part of the question, I think what we're seeing emerging is, well, keep in mind, before the Portuguese arrived in India in 1498, which heralded 500 years of Western dominance in the greater Indian Ocean, you had a very developed Hindu, Persian, Arab, Chinese trading system that operated all the way from Africa to the coastal cities of China. You have the remains of 7th and 8th century Arab and Persian mosques in China, for example. You had Chinese navigators in Yemen, for example. Everyone was everywhere along the ocean. And I think now what we're going to see is the reemergence of this trading system that is going to envelop East Africa as well and help to develop it. Yes, there is, I think, an undeclared competition between the United States and China in Africa. China is, and both the United States are prospecting for oil in the Gulf of Guinea. The United States has just set up AFRICOM, a separate military command alone for Africa, whose goal is to sustain democratic infrastructure and institutions throughout the continent, but which is undeclared is a subtle competition with China. China is basically saying to the Africans, you don't need democracy or anything like that. Let us extract your minerals, we'll pay you, and we'll help develop your infrastructure. The United States is saying no. The model that should work is to develop democratic institutions. So, I think what may happen, a good scenario for this would be a kind of African nations playing the United States off against China for their own benefit.
So I guess, ultimately the question is which system sounds more convincing to African
Well,
states?
It may not be an either-or decision.
Mm-hmm.
These countries may take both Chinese and American aid at the same time on their terms.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Ellen in Dallas. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please. Hi, go right ahead.
Okay. All right, here's my question to Mr. Kaplan. By the way, I read one of his books a few years ago, and I was very moved. I think it was called To the Ends of the Earth or something like that. But basically, my question is, given the fact that we are losing our position of supremacy in the world, and most Americans are terribly upset about it, but they're angry at Americans and at the current administration, what will it take, do you think, to wake Americans up to the fact that we're going to have to step up to the plate and, modernize and adapt?
It's interesting. I think I don't think there's going to be any one particular incident that's going to wake America up. I think there are gradual trends. China becoming the second largest economy, jumping ahead of Japan. Some decades down the road, a decade or so, China's going to jump in front of America as the world's largest economy. That's going to wake people up tremendously. I think that the gradual in relative terms, weakening of our military compared to other world militaries. And remember, I'm talking in relative terms, not in absolute terms. Americans need to wake up to the fact that we are going to still need a strong Navy and a strong Air Force. That's what gives us hard power. There's a lot to be said for soft power, of course. But we're also going to need hard power, and it's air and naval assets that give us credibility at the negotiating table much more than land assets do. America is will be a great power in the greater Middle East, even if it loses in Iraq and Afghanistan, because of the placement of our warships and our airplanes.
How close is China at this point to challenging the primacy of at least the U.S. Navy?
Not close at all.
Mm-hmm.
Not close at all. Don't think in terms, though, of an even-handed kind of sea battle like what occurred toward the close of World War II. Think in terms of asymmetric qualities at sea. We've seen the low-tech, dirty end of asymmetry in Iraq with roadside bombs. Think of things like a Chinese submarine surfacing in the midst of a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group and not doing anything, but simply being able to declare that they can penetrate our sea defenses. And, think of like an Iranian in swarm boats with shoulder-fired missiles being able to nick an American destroyer or frigate in the Persian Gulf. Think of asymmetry at sea and how this can hurt America's reputation for power.
So it sounds like the current administration and the Department of State are giving appropriate amounts of attention to the Indian Ocean and the countries that lie there.
I think they are.
Mm-hmm.
President Obama comes in for a lot of criticism lately. It seems that the media, parts of the public can't see anything right about him. But when I look at the world that I just wrote a book about, which to me is the emerging central part of the world, I see the administration really on board, really focusing on this.
So do they fully understand everything that you would want them to understand?
Well, of course they don't understand everything. But I think given the dynamic attention they're paying to India, to Indonesia, to the eastern and southern Eurasian rimland, I think they're doing a good job.
Well, I guess that's a hopeful thing, and we'll keep our eyes on India and China as time goes by. Robert D. Kaplan is a fellow at the Center for New American Security and national correspondent for The Atlantic. His new book is called Monsoon, The Indian Ocean and the Future of American Power. Robert, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
It's my pleasure, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.